From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, two perspectives on covering the news in South Africa. Richard Mkando is a black South African who covers his country for a Western Wire service. Joe Davidson is an African American covering South Africa for the Wall Street Journal. Also today, Bret Easton Ellis discusses his controversial new novel, American Psycho, about a serial killer who tortures and sexually mutilates his victims. And Tammy Bruce of the Los Angeles chapter of Now tells us why she's organized a boycott against it. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Unofficial reports emerging from Iraq speak of unrest continuing there over a wide area. Information on the rebellion comes mainly from Tehran radio and from radio stations operated by Iraqi opposition groups. Iraq's official news medium, Baghdad Radio, continues to make hardly any reference to the troubles. Gerald Butt reports from Nicosia.
The main emphasis of broadcasts on Baghdad Radio is on efforts being made by the authorities to bring life back to normal after the Gulf War. Also, measures have been announced aimed, it seems, at diminishing dissent against the government. On the whole, only oblique references have been made to anti-government unrest, with a clear message that it's being instigated by countries of the anti-Iraq coalition rather than by the Iraqi people themselves. Generally, Tehran radio has been the major source of news about the rebellion inside Iraq, sometimes quoting refugees fleeing across the border, on other occasions reporting statements from Iraqi opposition groups in exile. Rebel claims are also being broadcast from a radio station in Basra, which used to belong to the central government and was seized during the fighting last week. For National Public Radio, this is Gerald Butt in Nicosia.
The Pentagon said today that Iraq is using combat helicopters to fight insurgents in violation of an agreement between U.S. and Iraqi military commanders. Pentagon spokesman Bob Hall said that the use of the helicopters threatens ceasefire negotiations between Iraq and the Allies. NPR's Vicky O'Hara reports.
Spokesman Bob Hall says that Iraq originally asked the U.S. and its coalition partners to allow Iraqi forces to use helicopters to transport officials from one place to another, the reason being that Allied bombing had destroyed Iraqi roads and bridges. Now Hall explains Iraqi forces are using helicopters to fight Iraqi insurgents, thereby threatening what Hall called the climate of stability that the U.S. and its allies want to see before agreeing to any formal ceasefire in the Persian Gulf War. The Pentagon spokesman also says the U.S. military has no intention of getting involved in Iraq's internal strife and that U.S. forces are continuing to withdraw from southern Iraq. In Washington, this is Vicky O'Hara.
A new poll indicates that the success of the Persian Gulf War brought wider public support for President Bush, but not necessarily for military action overseas. A Los Angeles Times poll released today put the president's approval rating at 84%. It said that support was strong among all demographic groups, including women, black, Hispanic, and low-income people. Most said they agreed with the president's statement that the war would help create a new world order. Only 15% favored active use of U.S. military forces overseas. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost about 3 points today to close at 2,952. Declines and advances were about even in heavy trading. This is NPR. Czechoslovak President Václav Havel was jostled today by an angry crowd of Slovak nationalists in Bratislava. Havel was in the Slovak capital to try to defuse nationalist sentiments that threatened to split the country. Havel went on nationwide television to urge the Slovaks to hold a referendum on whether to separate or remain in a federation with the nation's Czech republics. The German government has called on the Soviet Union to return the former leader of communist East Germany. The Soviets have moved Erich Honecker to a Moscow hospital where he may avoid prosecution on murder charges. Deirdre Berger reports.
For the past year, the ailing 77-year-old Erich Honecker has been kept in a Soviet military hospital in East Berlin. Soviet officials made the decision in part to protect Honecker and his wife, who were verbally abused and pelted with objects when they tried to move into an East Berlin apartment last year. In Berlin today, Honecker's lawyers announced he'd been transferred to a hospital in Moscow because his health condition is deteriorating. Lawyer Wolfgang Ziegler called it a humanitarian gesture by the Soviets to improve medical care for the former communist leader. Soviet government officials have not yet responded to Bond's request for Honecker's extradition. He is wanted on murder charges for issuing shoot-to-kill orders along the Berlin Wall. For National Public Radio, this is Dieter Berger in Frankfurt.
The European Parliament voted today to condemn Germany for allegedly harassing German women suspected of having abortions in the Netherlands. Abortion is restricted in Western Germany, but available on demand in the Netherlands. German customs officials have asked German women returning from the Netherlands whether they've had abortions. In recent years, German news reports say that 10 returning women have been asked to undergo gynecological exams. The Dutch Justice Ministry has complained that such exams violated international freedom of movement. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This week, the government of South Africa introduced legislation aimed at further breaking down the system of apartheid. The proposed laws would allow blacks to own land and live in white areas. The new laws would repeal two of the foundations of apartheid, the Group Areas Act and the Land Acts. What was not addressed was restitution for the several million blacks who were forced out of their homes and off their land during the years of apartheid. Much has changed in South Africa in the year since Nelson Mandela has been released from jail. To get a sense of how things are today, we called two black journalists working in South Africa. A little later, we'll hear from Joe Davidson, an African-American covering South Africa for the Wall Street Journal. First, we call Johannesburg to talk with Rich Mkondo, a black South African who writes for a Western wire service. He's also written for the Rand Daily Mail and the Johannesburg Star. Mkondo says that repealing the Land Acts won't have an immediate impact on the lives of most black South Africans.
The actually social and economic effects of apartheid are going to take a very, very long time to remove. You should be aware that for many years, blacks have not been able to acquire any wealth. So that is the problem that the new government is going to have. And that is the problem that this government is having at the moment, because blacks are now demanding what they were supposed to have actually got many years ago. Since the government announced that the Group Areas Act, which decreed for many years where blacks and whites should live, will be abolished in July, very, very few people have moved from Soweto to the white neighborhoods. Very, very few people have moved or have managed to buy any property. Only those people like doctors and lawyers and other kind of professionals can manage to do it. But at the moment, it's going to take a very, very long time. I mean, in 10 years' time, we'll still have black townships, we'll still have white suburbs, and we'll still have those very poor conditions that are still there in the black church. That's just like what you have in Philadelphia, although the situation wouldn't be as much as we have now.
Sure, there's no legal... There's no law forcing whites and blacks to live separately, yet there's a lot of segregation.
Exactly.
Is the Winnie Mandela trial dividing blacks in South Africa?
I wouldn't say it is dividing blacks, but what it is doing is actually worrying a lot of people because of the way the ANC has responded to the trial itself. You see, at the beginning, the ANC has said that let the law take its course. But when the trial was just about to start, the ANC released a statement saying that if the trial actually goes ahead, it will be pure harassment. So, and then what they did, they then sent some of the ANC high profile people like Nelson Mandela and Chris Hani and so on to go and accompany Mrs. Mandela. And then there were quite a number of demonstrations outside the court. That actually worries a lot of people. And the disappearance of some of the key witnesses has also worried a lot of people. So the worry that actually is being brought by the case is the fact that many people believe that justice here is on trial.
What do you mean?
Mrs. Mandela should be tried and convicted by a court of law, not by the anti-apartheid movements here. As I said, the ANC sees it as a trial for as a trial of its political activities. The government sees it as just a criminal case. What I mean is that political interference by the ANC is causing a serious problem for what kind of government we're going to have in the future. If the ANC doesn't dissociate itself from the trial at the moment, how can it be? How can it be able to dissociate itself from future trials in South Africa? As an anti-apartheid figure, Mrs. Mandela should be left alone in court. Evidence should be heard. The witnesses should not be threatened by either the executive of the ANC or the ANC supporters not to give evidence. That's what I mean when I say the trial for the future justice of the country. Because if that is allowed to take place, what it means that in the future, if one of the political leaders is involved in any problems, we are going to see witnesses disappearing. We're going to see the government getting involved in the whole thing, and we are not going to have any justice at all.
Has the end of some of the apartheid laws made it any easier for you to do your job as a journalist and for you to go to places that you need to get to?
Yes, it has, in many ways, because for your information, I have managed to interview even right-wing politicians who never even spoken to blacks before. I can go to places where blacks were not allowed before, although there is still some resistance. There are not many restrictions like we used to have during the height of the state of emergency in 1986 and 87. And I can attend even a meeting or a political rally called by the ruling White National Party. I attended their Transvaal Province Congress late last year, and this couldn't have happened a long time ago.
Do police and government authorities cooperate with you and other black journalists?
Oh, of course, yes. I mean, they want to be seen to have changed. They cooperate a lot, actually. It appears to me, I mean, even the state on television now, some black journalists who work for the state television, you see them interviewing cabinet ministers, and this has never happened before.
You know, there was an article not too long ago in Newsweek that talked about pressures on black reporters in South Africa, pressures from other blacks to not report on things that would reflect badly on black South Africans. And there was even a quote from the editor of the Sowetan newspaper. He said, every black journalist in the country is receiving the severest harassment from black liberal organizations. Have you found that
quite
to
right.
be true? Yeah?
Yes, it has happened to me on many occasions. You see here, we are torn between the two.
Between two what?
Between the two, between our profession and our communities. You are supposed to be seen to be on the anti-apartheid course, even if you're a journalist who's supposed to be objective, if it is possible to be objective. To give you an example, when Mrs. Mandela was shunned by the anti-apartheid movement, we all actually watched to see what's going to happen to her. So we saw her being reincorporated into the anti-apartheid movement again. And I went on to interview people about this, and I followed her, what she's been doing. I wrote a feature about her coming back into the anti-apartheid fold. And the South African Youth Congress, which is an anti-apartheid movement which is allied to the ANC, was very upset about the story. So some of them called me to threaten me, and this has not actually happened to me alone. It has happened to many journalists. So our problem here is to be seen to be on the anti-apartheid cause while being a journalist. So if you write something that is not on the anti-apartheid cause, you're being accused of being anti-struggle.
What did you say in your article or articles about Winnie Mandela that offended black militants in South Africa, people who called and threatened you?
Well, first they objected to the fact that I said she was back into the anti-apartheid fold. They said she was never actually shunned, even if everybody was there when the United Democratic Front, an anti-apartheid alliance, called a press conference to say, from today onwards, we're not going to have anything to do with Mrs. Mandela. All I did was to go on the last stories that we had about her, about what was said about her, and what she's saying now, and what she's doing. And that's what actually upset them. And they also did not want to see anything written about Mrs. Mandela's involvement in the murder or into the assault of a young activist, which led to his death. And that's the basis of the trial now. They said I was simply repeating what has been reported before. And they think that I was working for the system. So those two things.
What are some of the changes you're hoping for in the near future now that so many of the apartheid laws are being dismantled?
Well, that's a very, very difficult question, because even if apartheid is gone, we don't know what is actually in store for us. The parties that are going to be in power haven't actually explained what they stand for. But as I said to you, a vote doesn't mean that one will be able to get everything one wanted. But the nice thing about it is that one will be able to determine his own future. I actually sincerely hope that we'll have a very democratic government which will be able to look at all the aspects of life in South Africa and take them into consideration. My biggest worry is the education. The second one is the housing. I think the first thing that our government needs to do is to look into the great education system. Many people who are under the age of 18 are just roaming the streets, not doing anything, merely because apartheid for many years has prevented them from getting the kind of education that they wanted. When I say prevented them, I mean that you're supposed to be 18 to be able to remain in high school. Otherwise, you will be forced out to actually give way for others. And this has actually has made that a lot of people remain uneducated. I myself actually struggled to get my education. I only got my degree when I was about 22. Actually, not even 22, 26. And I started my university education when I was 22 and finished when I was 26. So that is the first priority. That is my hope, that the government of the future will be able to tackle that kind of problem.
Ruchi Mkhando reports from South Africa for a Western Wire service. He spoke to us from Johannesburg. Coming up, an African-American perspective on covering the news in South Africa. This is Fresh Air. Joe Davidson is an African-American covering South Africa for the Wall Street Journal. Davidson has been there since January, and he hopes to remain for a few years. We called Joe Davidson in Johannesburg earlier today. Since he arrived in Johannesburg just as the apartheid laws are being dismantled, I asked him what restrictions he still faces as a black in South Africa.
Well, just a couple of days ago, I went to an apartment not far from the hotel where I'm still staying, but we'll move from shortly. But I went to this apartment because it's in this neighborhood called Bromfontein. There's a lot of things here, and it's a very convenient neighborhood, so I thought I'd check this apartment out. And the caretaker, a black man, came to the door, really the gate, and said, this apartment building is for whites only. You know, we don't rent to blacks. You know, there was no getting around some sort of facade or charade by saying we're full when they really aren't full. They simply come right out and say, well, we don't rent to blacks. Now, one thing I think that's worth pointing out about the new South Africa is that discrimination is not illegal, and the government is not proposing to make discrimination illegal. The situation before was that non-discrimination was illegal. In other words, it was the law to exercise white racism. It was the law that you had to discriminate in some situations. They are removing those laws, certainly proposing to remove those laws, but they aren't doing anything affirmative in terms of non-discriminatory statutes in their place. So it's perfectly legal for me to be told that I can't get an apartment because I'm black.
Are you treated differently from whites or white officials when they hear your American accent?
You mean, am I treated differently than other blacks?
Differently than other blacks, yeah. I'm wondering if there's this sense of that, you know, American blacks are different.
Well, I think what they try to do is to impress upon Americans in general, this being white officials, that South Africa really isn't so bad, that Americans really don't understand South Africa, and that America, too, has big problems. They really don't, let an example of something, of some shortcoming in the U.S. as it relates to race relations, and clearly there are many, but they certainly don't let those examples pass by unnoticed. You know, you're kind of lumped in this class of Americans, and they seem to think that Americans feel a sense of superiority over South Africans or the South African government, at least as it relates to race relations. And I guess in some sense, I tend to let them know that I clearly understand the degree of racism in America, so they don't have to try to impress that upon me. But I think they do that just so that they can say, well, we aren't so bad.
Have you been reporting on the Winnie Mandela trial?
Yes, I've written about it. I don't write about it every day, but I've been to the trial, and I certainly keep up with what's going on. I talk to lawyers on both sides, the defense attorney and the prosecutors, to get an idea of what's going on. And that certainly has captured the headlines here.
Has covering the Winnie Mandela trial been problematic for you because of the Mandela's place in you know, the Black Freedom Movement in South Africa?
No, it really hasn't been problematic for me. It was, I guess, though, in some ways, it's a story I wish I didn't have to do, and by that I mean I wish it didn't happen. I think that the, and what I wrote was that I think that in this Winnie Mandela situation, the ANC has veered off of the high road, in a sense. I mean, I frankly don't think that they've taken a principled position, and that's disappointing to me. But that's the way it is, at least in my view. I mean, I think that the Winnie Mandela trial is a very emotion-laden case. But when the witnesses were refusing to testify and this other witness disappeared, I thought that the ANC, and specifically Nelson Mandela, should have made a very strong statement saying that the ANC will simply not tolerate intimidation of witnesses in their name, or made a strong statement, in a sense, urging those witnesses to testify. The point is, the ANC may have very clean hands in all of this, but they didn't take the high road to make sure that their hands were seen to be clean.
Has there been any pressure on you by people in the anti-apartheid movement to not say anything that would reflect badly on the movement?
No, but I think local black reporters get that. There's a case of one black reporter who works for a paper called the City Press who wrote a story about the People's Courts, which when they, I guess, were in their heyday, they, some of them at least, amounted to kangaroo courts, and people could be convicted of something, let's say theft, on very little evidence, and then subjected to a whipping, lashes across the back, maybe 50 lashes or something. And I don't know this particular reporter, but I do know about his case. He was a black reporter for a black-oriented newspaper, wrote about some of these people's courts, and he in turn was taken before a people's court and was punished for his writing. And I've had black reporters tell me that there are things that they can't write about because I guess still the hypersensitive, well, I guess I don't necessarily want to call the black community hypersensitive because I think the black community has plenty of reason to be sensitive, but there are times when the black community can does not take criticism well, to put it mildly, and if you point out you know, something and you're a black reporter, then yes, black reporters do feel I guess in a sense intimidated. I guess that's the word.
When you're in white areas now in South Africa, do you feel like you have to look over your shoulder or anything? Are you ever worried about your safety, especially now that there seems to be something of a backlash?
Well, not right here in Johannesburg. In Johannesburg, in some ways, you feel like you're in, you know, any big city in the USA, which is as much an indictment on the USA, I think, as it is, or maybe a compliment to Joburg. By that, I mean, if you go into a restaurant, a nice restaurant, you may be the only black person or black couple there. And, you know, there's similar things like that in the U.S. And you may or may not get some stares, and you may or may not in the U.S. get some stares. Generally, the people who wait on you, though, are very friendly, and the Afrikaners can treat you very, very well, kind of on a one-to-one level. If you're talking about exchange of power, it might be something else, but clearly they can be very courteous to you. But clearly, though, this is right here in the central cities, the big cities. You don't have big problems. Once you get out, though, you can have some serious problem, and I think the further you get from big cities like Johannesburg, probably the more danger you may be in.
Well, Joe, I want to thank you a lot for spending some time with us on the phone.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Joe Davidson reports from South Africa for the Wall Street Journal. He spoke to us from Johannesburg. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Philadelphia. I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Bret Easton Ellis wrote his new novel, American Psycho, from the perspective of a madman who tortures, rapes, mutilates, and murders women. Coming up, Ellis talks about his controversial new novel. Also, Tammy Bruce of the Los Angeles chapter of the National Organization for Women tells us why her group is boycotting Ellis's book and his publishing company. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Former U.S. prisoners of war spoke today for the first time in public about their capture and captivity in Iraq during news conferences at the hospitals where they are being treated. Over a dozen former POWs told both of Iraqi beatings and kindness. NPR's Michael Scholar has more.
When Allied POWs, bruised and robot-like, appeared on Iraqi television early in the war, many feared Iraq was torturing the prisoners. Today, several of the POWs confirmed that, saying they were beaten. One described how wires were attached to his head to deliver electric shocks. Navy Lieutenant Jeffrey Zahn told how his televised statement condemning the war was staged.
They took me to a TV studio, set me up next to the big guy that I was asking the questions. They told me what, I guess, five questions they were going to ask. Then they told me what my answers were going to be.
Not all POWs say they were mistreated, and some have stories of Iraqi kindness, like when enemy soldiers splinted a POW's leg. Most POWs are expected to go home in the next few days, and more details of their time in Iraq will likely emerge then. This is Michael Scholar in Washington.
President Bush says that allies have not decided on one path to solve Arab-Israeli differences. Meeting today with French President Mitterrand, Mr. Bush also said that he was hopeful that post-war efforts to find peace in the Middle East would lead to the release of 13 Western hostages still held in Lebanon. There were celebrations in Kuwait City today as Kuwait's ruling emir returned to the country 7 months after fleeing the Iraqi invasion. From Kuwait City, NPR's Deborah Wong reports.
The emir arrived aboard a Kuwaiti Airlines jet and was ushered out to a small ceremony near a bombed-out section of the airport. He was greeted by government ministers, dignitaries, and personal friends. There were few ordinary Kuwaiti citizens on hand to welcome the emir. Most were kept away by a tight ring of security. The emir made no statement upon his arrival. He was quickly whisked away to his temporary residence in the city. Although the emir's return was intended to be a low-key affair, there were celebrations in the capital as word spread. At nightfall, the streets looked something like they did on the first days of liberation, with cars flying flags and displaying portraits of the emir. One government minister said the emir will be receiving well-wishers in the coming days, but there is no word as to when or if he will address the people. I'm Deborah Wong in Kuwait City.
In Washington, the government said today that business sales went down for the third month in a row in January, while at the same time, inventories moved up. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down almost 3 points to close at 2,952.23 on volume of some 231 million shares. This is NPR News. On Capitol Hill, the nomination of former Tennessee Governor Lamar Alexander has been approved by the Senate in a voice vote. Approval comes after a Senate committee probe of his personal financial dealings while in office found no evidence of wrongdoing. With the education post filled, President Bush now has a complete cabinet after a midterm shuffle. Congress is on the brink of passing a package of pay increases, educational aid, and other benefits for veterans of the Persian Gulf War. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Yesterday, the House passed a huge package of benefits totaling $1.1 billion for veterans not only of the Gulf War, but other wars as well. Swept up in the post-war euphoria and anxious to go on record in support of the troops, House members approved a package of benefits, ignoring the fact that the amount exceeds limits set by last year's budget agreement between Congress and the Bush administration. Those limits were to be exceeded only under an emergency. In a letter to the House, the administration said many of the proposed benefits are not urgently needed at this time. Meanwhile, in the Senate, a bipartisan compromise version was passed, a much smaller package that would only apply to soldiers and veterans who served in the Gulf War. It would improve benefits for education, home and small business loans, and health insurance. It's half the amount proposed by the House. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
The government says that real estate problems for banks and savings and loans grew worse last year and shifted to the Northeast and Mid-Atlantic states from the Southwest. However, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation says that profits at the nation's commercial banks went up 6.5% in 1990. The banking industry in nine states and the District of Columbia lost money, with the worst losses found in the state of Massachusetts. In trading in Europe, the dollar was mixed against other major foreign currencies. Gold prices were also mixed. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Bret Easton Ellis used to be typed as a member of the literary Brat Pack. His novel Less Than Zero was published when he was 19. His second novel was a critical and commercial flop. But it seems everyone has an opinion of his new novel, American Psycho. The story is told from the perspective of Patrick Bateman, a 26-year-old who works on Wall Street. He spends half his life absorbed with the designer names that stand for money and refinement, and the other half of his life is spent torturing, sexually mutilating, and murdering women. The gruesome descriptions are so detailed, the episodes of mutilation so numerous, that many readers have been outraged. The original publisher, Simon & Schuster, dropped the book at the last minute. It was picked up by Vintage soon after. As for the literary reviews, Jonathan Yardley of the Washington Post called the book loathsome, a bloodbath serving no purpose save that of morbidity, titillation, and sensation. But in the New York Times, Christopher Lehmanhaupt doubted the book was written with commercial exploitation in mind. If so, commercialism has never before produced anything so boring. One of the more charitable reviews came from Norman Mailer, who basically said the novel wasn't well written enough to be great art, but not so badly written that he could simply reject it. I asked Ellis what effect the controversy was having on him personally.
There have been a few death threats, but other than that, most people in publishing, whether they like the book or not, have been fairly supportive, and it's not been that rough a time.
What freedom of speech issues do you think the controversy surrounding your book raises?
I don't see it as raising any freedom of speech issues. That, to me, just isn't applicable to this. I think that's a confusing question to me because I just don't see how it comes into play.
Well, now is calling for a boycott against your publisher because of your book.
Oh, which is absolutely ridiculous. I mean, I have a very hard time taking now and this so-called boycott seriously. I don't understand it. What are we asking here? Should I be allowed to have written this book? Is that what it comes down to? Well, yeah, I think I should have been allowed to have written this book. And a publisher has every right to either decide to publish the book or not to publish the book, just like every reader has a right to buy the book or not to buy the book.
The serial killers' mutilations and murders are described in very explicit language, and there's many episodes of the mutilation and murder that he carries out. I guess I'd be really interested in hearing what it was that you were going through that made you want to enter this character's mind in such a detailed kind of way.
Well, when I first decided to write this book, I knew that I wanted to write a first-person narrated novel from the point of view of a serial killer. Now, why that character came into my head and why he intrigued me, I don't know. There might be a million reasons. It's very hard to verbalize why you choose a subject or why a subject chooses you. I can't say.
I always assume that when a writer gets really deeply involved with a certain subject matter, that it's something that they deeply care about in one way or another. Either it's something that really frightens them, or it's something that's a part of themselves. It's something that haunts them, or that they're passionate about, or whatever. And I guess I'm curious about where your obsession with your character's obsession comes from. If it comes from a fear, from a nightmare, from something you were trying to purge from your own personality, or what?
Well, I don't know. I tend to see it on a much more conceptual level than that. I mean, to me, What keeps me going when I'm writing a novel is not so much, well, at least not yet in my career, but so far it has not been whether I love the characters or whether I think this is a really neat narrative and I can't wait to see where it's going. I'm more or less interested in the language of the book and catching the rhythms of speech of whatever narrator I've chosen to write about. So to me, I'm much more interested in, I don't know, structure, language. To me, those, right now, at this point in my career, I'm far more interested in, I guess, the holding blocks, the building blocks that make up a book, rather than, I don't know, characterization, narrative.
You've spent 3 years writing the book, and it's, you know, it's a book of very intense subject matter and very detailed, brutal descriptions. And you put yourself through this for a long time. You put yourself through the research about serial killers and violence, and then put yourself through having to imagine all of this in vivid detail yourself. And I still don't feel like I really understand what it was that so fascinated you about the character that you created. And I'm not asking that in an accusatory way. Mm-hmm. It's just what I'd ask any writer who spent the amount of time that you spent on a subject that requires such a kind of leap of the imagination.
But in many ways, I don't see this as a book solely about a serial killer. And I guess in many ways, I think what you're asking is what brought you to stick with this character for 3 years? And I don't know. I mean, the book is not autobiographical in any sense, but in many ways it, I guess, kind of defines my take on a certain time, which is the 1980s, in a certain place, which was basically Wall Street in Manhattan. And I guess the ugliness of the book reflects my take on that.
Still, though, I mean, when you're dealing with somebody who stabs someone in the eyeballs, drills out their teeth, rapes somebody with rats, sticks things in there, in every imaginable orifice, I mean, there's something beyond my interest in Wall Street, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Or in the consumer culture of the 80s that's leading to that. And I guess I don't feel like I know yet what it is. And again, I'd accept if you didn't know it either, but you know, it's just beyond, it seems to me it goes beyond like my take on the 80s.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, no, I can totally understand that. I don't know. I mean,
I feel funny here, like I'm putting you on the spot.
No,
I don't think
an
author should be forced to explain themselves.
Not at all. But
it's like what I'd really like to hear about.
In many ways, those scenes, the scenes that a lot of people have objected to, I don't know. In many ways, I guess you can look at them metaphorically. I mean, I guess you can look at them as solely as expressions of Patrick's rage. To me, that's basically it in many ways. I mean, of course, there's a lot of undercurrents to those scenes also, but I think in many ways, the violence in those sequences to me seems so, I don't know, so it's almost abstract to me. I mean, it's almost so over the top that it becomes abstract. And something I was thinking about while writing it was wondering how desensitized our culture is toward violence. And does violence really shock us anymore?
Did you want to shock your readers?
Well, I don't know if I wanted to shock my readers. Maybe I wanted to shock myself. Maybe
Did you shock yourself?
Yeah. It's true. No, I was shocked.
And what was your reaction when you started shocking yourself? Did you want to withdraw from the material, or did it lead you deeper into it?
I was so upset by it at first that the only way I could approach it was to, I guess, intellectualize it and alienate myself from it as much as possible.
My guest is Bret Easton Ellis, author of the new novel American Psycho. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Novelist Bret Easton Ellis is my guest. I've called the hotline from the Los Angeles chapter of the National Organization for Women, and they have like a 17-minute message on the hotline that tells people calling
disgusting.
In how they can call your publisher and your agent and so on. And then they read, the head of the chapter reads an excerpt of your book to show...
Oh, my God.
To show like how vile she thinks it is. Have you heard it? Have you called the number?
Well, I actually did call it in, I guess it was November or early December when they started doing this. I don't know what I can say. I mean, I am not, or I don't think I ever will write a novel that's going to, I don't know, appease women? I mean, I'm going to sit down and write a novel that purposefully will not offend a woman's sensibility. That makes no sense to me. I mean, I think this book would be far more offensive to serial killers than it would be to women. I mean, that's something that still shocks me to this day, that, again, now, and especially, I guess, Tammy Bruce, who's the head of the L.A. Coalition of Now, seem to think that... I am Patrick Bateman, and because of that, this book should be banned or boycotted or whatever, and so should a lot of other product from Knopf and vintage books.
What
is ridiculous.
What the head of Now, of the LA chapter of Now, says on the tape is that the book presents in a nonchalant, sexually exciting way the torture of women simply because they're women.
Well, I don't know. I mean, would this whole, fiasco have started if Patrick Bateman was gay and was killing young men? I mean, the fact that I even have to ask that question just makes me cringe. But I don't know. Would people be outraged then if he was committing the same sort of hideous acts on young men? I don't know. But...
You think it's unfair to ask a writer to think about things like that?
I think it's unfair to ask a writer why he wrote something.
Mm-hmm.
Because that automatically suggests that you've done something wrong, that you've been bad. And I would never ask someone who, I don't know, wrote a song, a play, whatever. I would never ask them why they wrote something. I mean, I would hope most people are adult enough to realize that a lot of art speaks for itself. And you can make up your own minds about it, and you don't need the writer there hand-holding you through this experience.
Bret Easton Ellis is the author of the new novel American Psycho. Coming up, an interview with Tammy Bruce, who organized a boycott against the book.
With a swastika tattoo, there is a vacancy waiting in the English voodoo carver. Deep for vandal on the field to boss head. When it's had enough for that, maybe you'll take him to bed too. Sure he's alive, or he wishes he was dead. Turn up the TV, no one listening will suspect, even your mother won't detect. So your father won't know. They think that I got no respect, but everything means less than zero. Hit, 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 hit.
This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Hi, Linda.
Hi, Terry. We have a report from the Department of Health and Human Services which says that for the first time, the firearm death rates for both white and black male teenagers exceeded the total from all natural causes of death combined. We'll talk to the Secretary of Health and Human Services, Louis Sullivan, tonight on the program. The POWs are talking to the press since for the first time since their return. The Emir of Kuwait has returned to his country. Deb Amos has returned to her home in London, and we'll talk to her about the, you know, how to get fed and housed in a war zone while you're covering a big story. And the Attorney General has called for a federal investigation of the L.A. police.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The Los Angeles chapter of NOW, the National Organization for Women, has organized a boycott of Bret Easton Ellis's new novel, American Psycho, and all books by his publisher, with the exception of their books by feminist writers. Earlier today, I called Tammy Bruce, the head of the chapter, and asked her why she organized the boycott.
This is a matter of life and death. Violence against women in this country is at epidemic proportions. We are living in a culture which glorifies violence against women. We've got to begin to take a stand and say, not don't you dare publish this, but if you publish this, you will face the consequences of a people that are tired of being faced with this kind of gratuitous glorification of violence against women. It is a very, very big difference than simply being offended by something. It's a big difference than, say, the minority saying, we don't like that when everyone else does like it. The bottom line is, really, honestly, no one wants this crap. It's not about religious or political issues at all. It's about the difference between common sense and responsible decision-making and the fact that women die torturous deaths in this country every day because our culture invites it and encourages it.
I think when somebody objects to the content of a book or a movie, what's often in question is whether that book or movie is advocating a certain act. Like, does American Psycho advocate violence against women, or is it trying to be a comment about a society mm-hmm. in which there are acts of violence mm-hmm. against women? Mm-hmm. Is it perpetrating misogyny, or is it trying to get into the mind mm-hmm. of a misogynist?
Mm-hmm. No, it's a very good question. It's a very distinct difference, because we have both in this culture. As an example, we like Silence of the Lambs. The film presents a very empowering view of women, even though it presents a very horrific experience that women have. American Psycho, in reading the original manuscript and now what has been published, exists to exploit. The question is, does it exploit or does it educate? It exploits. To say that it was written as social commentary is pathetic. It is written to exploit the fear and death women live with every day. The attempts to justify this are about as pathetic as the material itself.
Well, don't you think that's something that intelligent people could disagree about, as there's been some disagreement among literary critics as to the relative worth of this?
Okay, there's been little disagreement. There has literally been, if you have seen some of the background and some of the reviews, ranging from when it was at Simon & Schuster to currently, there has been tremendously little disagreement about it's not like Hemingway had a bad day here. If this is what literature has come down to, then there is a very serious problem, and we want to tell Sunny Maida that this is not what literature has come down to, and this is not what we're willing to accept.
You know, I think it's fair to say that what some critics are saying about the book is that, you know, Bret Easton Ellis has some ambitions, but those ambitions are confused, and that his writing isn't good enough to support the ambitions of the novels. But, you know, the ambitions of the novel, you know, that the book may be a literary failure, but that's not a reason to boycott it. I mean, I've read that by several critics. I think it's fair to say that the critics are all unanimously condemning the book in the way that you're condemning it.
I don't think that there was ever an attempt to have this be a social commentary. There was never an attempt to have this be some grandiose expose of the desensitization of Americans toward violence. This was written plain and simply to attack women. It was written in a pornographic, sadistic, misogynistic sense without debate. This was never with the attempt to be some kind of major statement, and then it disintegrated into pornography. I think not. There was never an attempt. The attempt is clear, which was to be sensationalistic misogyny in an attempt to revive a failing career of a young man who is not a good writer, who experienced a fluke, and now was reaching for the extremes in order to get a little bit more notoriety, when in fact what this book has done is shown a light into Knopf. Bret Easton Ellis can write this crap until he chokes on his own vomit. The problem is the Sunny Maidas and Amanda Urbans of the world who peddle it and decide to push it through into the fabric of our culture and make cultural decisions but we are not relegated only to positive responses. We will say no, and we will say it loudly.
On the message on the answering machine for the boycott hotline, mm-hmm. you give the phone numbers and fax numbers for the main parties who who are responsible for publishing the book. And one of the people who you tell listeners to fax and phone is Bret Easton Ellis's agent, Amanda Urban, who mm-hmm. is known by the nickname of Binky. And you say, clearly she's compromised all her principles as a woman in her effort to make a fast buck. Mm-hmm. And so you're suggesting implementing a Binky watch to see if there's a pattern
here.
We're
not suggesting it. We have implemented it.
But, you know, it makes it sound like you're the politically correct thought police. You know what I mean? That you're getting people to...
We as much as Mr. Ellis and Ms. Urban have every intention of expressing our point of view and proceeding in a fashion which seems relevant to what we need to achieve. It is not unusual for women who have achieved success in a male-dominated field, which is most of them, who have achieved success through playing by the boys' rules, to find that misogyny pays. To find that misogyny makes one successful. And we want to make sure that Amanda, Binky, actually she prefers to be called Binky, we want to make sure she knows she does not work in a vacuum, that she is making decisions that affect people's lives and affect their deaths, as does Mr. Maida.
Tammy Bruce, thank you very much for talking with us.
You got it.
Tammy Bruce is the head of the Los Angeles chapter of the National Organization for Women. Fresh Air's producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Joan Tui and Roberta Shurrock are our production assistants. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, James Fallows, on how we're still punishing Vietnam because we didn't win the war. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.